This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are slated to hear from the fabulous singer Philip Manuel of New Orleans. He's been around for a long time and is still performing with great success, and we will talk with him about busy week for him and the music community in Louisiana, particularly in the great city of New Orleans. Also, Michael Pollan, considered to be perhaps the foremost food expert in the world. He has written a new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. He goes into the kitchen this time, does Michael Pollan. His previous book was an overwhelming bestseller, The Omnivore's Dilemma. And Kishore Mbambi, he is a writer, professor, and former Singaporean diplomat who served twice as ambassador to the UN. His book is The Great Convergence. All this, now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. Your numbers are 877-217-5757, wherever you may be. Dialing locally, 297-5633, and you may reach us online, inkstershow@wrkf.org. It's a busy time at the legislative session as lawmakers are scurrying to the finish line of June 6th with much work still to be done regarding the budget, and we will talk a bit about that, but we begin with a fascinating gentleman who knows that this is a week like no other in the world of music, and he's a big part of it, and he has been for many years, jazz singer Philip Manuel, the pride of New Orleans, who has spent quality time for many years right here in Baton Rouge performing at various venues. Good morning, Philip Manuel.
Good morning, Jim. Wow, what an introduction. The check is in the mail.
Well,
that's pretty good.
I don't know of a better voice in the state of Louisiana than the man we're talking to, and it's something that you graced the stages with for many years, and people talk about overnight recognition. Well, you've worked a long time to be a part of the scene, and you've got a big week this week.
Yeah, I got a busy week coming up. Tomorrow night, I'm doing my Nat King Cole tribute at Cafe Istanbul in New Orleans. The show is at 8 o'clock, and I don't know, for the folks who don't know where Cafe Istanbul is, it's on St. Claude Avenue, 2372 St. Claude, in a building called the Healing Center. And then on Thursday, of course, is my jazz best performance with Jermaine Basil and Leslie Smith and a really big band doing some great arrangements. We're at the Jazz Tent at 2:30 in the afternoon. So that, and of course, I'm working on a new record, so there's a lot going on musically for me right now.
I bet you're old enough to remember the first Jazz Fest.
Well, I am old enough to remember it. I don't think I went. It was 1971 or 72, something like that. I do remember it, but I wasn't there.
Are you... Are you amazed at the life of its own that this has taken? It's not only a signature event in Louisiana and New Orleans, but really for anybody who loves music on the planet, the Jazz Fest in New Orleans is a significant time of the year.
Yeah, you know, I understand, Jim, that it's actually not the biggest festival in the world, music festival, one of the top five for sure. It has grown tremendously in the last 40 years. It's hard to believe. I don't know how they can get all those people into the 36 acres of the fairground.
Well, you have performed through the years before big crowds, small crowds, and all kinds of places. For years, Thursday night at Geno's was a time and place where you could see and hear Philip Manuel. It's been a while since you've done that, but I'm sure many in our audience remember those days and nights.
Yeah, I did Geno's, man, every Thursday for 3 years. I mean, literally, every Thursday for 3 years. And I love Geno's. I look forward to coming back and doing a little bit more there.
And you, of course, come to Baton Rouge frequently, performed at LSU with our friend Bill Grimes on many occasions. That's something else that's quite memorable. I'm sorry?
Yeah, we do, what is it, the Hot Summer Nights series?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I've been doing that for a few years with Bill and Willis Deloney and the folks at LSU. And it's one of my favorite concerts of the year. I mean, the place is always packed, and you just have a really good time.
Now, I don't know of anybody who has a more versatile voice than does Philip Manuel. And one moment he can sound like Bill Withers, another like Lou Rawls. And it's an amazing voice. How do you do it?
Well, you know, I don't know, Jim. I guess it was just my gift. You know, the good Lord blessed me with a voice, and I don't know anything about fixing cars or working on computers, but, you know, my voice works pretty good, and I've managed to make a career out of it. I do a lot of narration for film and tons of radio and TV commercials, voiceovers and stuff like that. And, of course, you know, the singing has kept me pretty busy.
Well, Kevin Gallagher, before we talk more with this most interesting gentleman, let's give a listen to the incomparable Philip Manuel, Pride of New Orleans.
Just after midnight, love walked into my life, and right then everything changed. I talk with Starbright, my best friend is Moonlight, so close that they even know my name. Just how or why, it's hard to tell, but I know when it was after 12. Just after midnight, love walked into my life. Now my love and midnight go hand in hand.
The great Philip Manuel.
Wow. I hadn't heard that in a while. I wrote that years ago with the best songwriting partner I've ever had, Michael Pallera. I hadn't heard that in years. Thanks for playing that.
Well, anything Philip does is good. And you say you've been influenced by many people, some of whom I think our audience would be surprised, like Andy Williams. Andy Williams had an effect on you. How so?
Well, you know, I grew up listening to variety shows that, you know, I mean, my grandmother and I on Saturday evenings, it was Mitch Miller, Lawrence Welk, Andy Williams, and whatever else, you know, came on that presented music. And that's how I learned a lot of songs. And I was drawn to those kinds of shows, of course. But I just thought Andy Williams, and he just had a phenomenal voice, just the most beautiful voice. And, of course, he was one of my influences. My father was probably my biggest. But, you know, Donny Hathaway, Garland, oddly enough, and, of course, Ella Fitzgerald was my all-time favorite.
Graduated from Cohen High School in New Orleans and attended UNO and went in the Air Force. And many may not know, you actually moved to Washington, D.C. for a few years.
Lived in D.C. from 1983 to 86. I was really chasing that dream, Jim. I had a manager up there. We were going after a record contract. We were close to signing with a big-time producer who actually produced Madonna's very first record, the Borderline record that really got her going. We were close to signing a production deal with him, and things just didn't work out. And, you know, I moved back to New Orleans a couple of years later and continued with my career.
Well, it's our good fortune that you have performed in New Orleans, and you will tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, Cafe Istanbul at 2372 St. Claude. And it's Nat King Cole, a man who died in 1965, much too young. I think he was 47.
He was 45.
What a legacy. Yeah. What a legacy.
Yeah, he lived a busy and full life.
And his music. Was there anyone quite like him?
Well, there's no voice quite like his. I mean, there were greats. Of course, Frank Sinatra, one of the greatest ever, Billy Eckstein. But Nat's voice is like, you know, it's one of the most distinctive voices you'll ever hear. I mean, once you hear it, you know it's him. It's like Aaron Neville. When you hear his voice, you know it's Aaron Neville. Same with Nat. There's no mistake.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah. In some recent interviews, you've talked about your past. You said you had attention deficit hyperactive disorder early in life. How have you addressed that?
Well, you know, not only early in life, but continued. I mean, I actually wasn't diagnosed until I was in my 40s, and it was my wife who kind of, she had always said, you know, there's a disconnect somewhere. There's something, and she was having a conversation with a coworker who mentioned a cousin or a relative who was dealing with it, and she said, my, that sounds like my husband. And, well, long story short, I found a specialist in the disorder, and he diagnosed it pretty plainly and clearly. It was obvious after I had done my homework on it that I was dealing with it. But, you know, it's something that's affected my whole life. And, of course, now I take medication to, you know, to help control the, you know, with ADHD, it's just about being able to focus and get your work done. It's not really a, you know, people think of it in different ways, like it's some disability. And I guess for some it is, but, you know, it's been a double-edged sword for me because it keeps me on stage. It works just great. But sometimes when I need to sit down and focus on writing an editorial or writing a paper or something, it's a little bit more difficult. So I you know, take medication for it, and just try and, get some habits that keep me, you know, focused.
What's your favorite place to perform in New Orleans, outside of the place you'll be tomorrow night?
I like the club scene in New Orleans. Snug Harbor is always good. That's a place that I play, occasionally. And I really like Istanbul. They're set up for music, and, you know, when you come there, you know you're there to listen to music. And there's, of course, a lot of new clubs where a lot of the younger kids play and different kind of music. I haven't done any of those, but, you know.
You've played in places where people are smoking and drinking and talking, and here's one of the great vocalists of all time singing. And sometimes I think it's like being a prophet in your own land. Maybe people don't appreciate the talent before them.
Well, you know, I that probably used to bother me, but as you get older, you just get a real thick skin about stuff like that, and you realize for some jobs you're hired for, your purpose is one thing, and for other jobs, specifically a concert where people are there to listen, and you just kind of go with the flow and make the best of the situation. I've just found, man, you just need to stay as positive as you can and, you know, do what it is you do and do it as best you can.
Katie inquires about your favorite Nat Cole song. Is there one that you prefer above others among a catalog of classics?
Answer me, oh my love. Just what sin have I been guilty of? Just what I did to lose your love? Please answer me, sweetheart. That's got to be it.
That sounded like Nat King Cole coming back from the grave.
Answer me, my love. I'm a little raspy this morning because I worked last night, but I closed the show with that song. It's my favorite.
How do you take care of that great voice of yours?
Man, you know, I don't worry about it so much anymore. It's kind of like cast iron now. You know, it's pretty stout, and I've used it all my life. Of course, it's gotten deeper and, you know, darker, but that's a part of getting older. I just, try to drink water and get as much rest as you can.
Have you ever smoked?
No.
No?
Not a smoker.
But, of course, Nat King Cole did, and...
It's what killed him.
Yeah, and Frank Sinatra did, and Dean Martin did. Just about everybody of that era did it. And
I mean, I smoke an occasional cigar, you know, but I've never been a cigarette smoker.
Of course, I'm sure you've consumed much passive smoke through the years.
Tons of it.
What about the Jazz Fest as we finish up? Thursday, 2:30, you'll be there. As you know, it's kind of hard to cram as many people as they get in there, and Thursdays aren't quite like Saturdays and Sundays, but still, how is it performing in the chaos that has become the fairgrounds for Jazz Fest?
It's magical, man. I mean, it's one of my favorite times of the year. This last weekend in April, first weekend in May, the weather is usually very nice. I mean, the Jazz Fest is the world stage. You know, people come from all over for this festival. You've got some of the biggest names in the business. Billy Joel, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Maroon 5. I mean, you know, everybody's there. So the Jazz Festival is such a well-run and efficient operation. I don't feel the chaos. I mean, you know, the people who attend may get, you know, be caught up in the crowd thing, but for the musicians, it's just so well-run and so efficient.
Well, thank you, Philip Manuel. 8 o'clock tomorrow night at the Cafe Istanbul, St. Claude Avenue, New Orleans, and 2:30 Saturday Fairgrounds, the Jazz Fest.
This Thursday.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Philip.
Jim, thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Take care, my friend.
See you soon.
That's a deal. We'll be back to talk about the legislative session with none other than C.B. Forgodston. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. 297-5633 is your number. C.B. for Godston is the guest, the Capitol Watcher of renown, former chief counsel for the House Appropriations Committee a few moons ago, but a man who still follows the state capitol from his perch in Tangipahoa Parish. And you may read more about C.B.'s work at forgodston.com. Good morning, C.B.
Morning, Jim. Thank you for having me on.
Well, I want to cover some ground with you, and here's something that hasn't gotten a lot of play, but it's a bill that I think CB is probably responsible for, filed by John Bell Edwards, Democrat Amite, candidate for governor, to require high-salaried political appointees to register their cars in Louisiana. What is this about, CB?
Well, I had very publicly complained about the failure of state employees who were appointed by Bobby Jindal to from out of state to comply with the existing law, which is that within 30 days of becoming a resident of Louisiana, you must register your personal vehicle in Louisiana and secure a Louisiana driver's license. The importance of registering your vehicle is not only for, you know, identification purposes, but it means that you've paid your required use tax on vehicles that are brought in from out of state. Some of these people that work for Governor Jindal have worked here for 2 years, have residences here, and refused to comply. I had approached the state police, the inspector general, Office of Motor Vehicles, and for reasons best known to them, they were unable to enforce the existing law. Representative Edwards found out about my frustration through some of my emails and offered, which I thought was very nice, to give up one of his five non-fiscal bills with this session to address the issue. The language he came up with was suggested by the Louisiana State Police in order to not make it a problem, the burdensome to enforce the law, but make it very clear. And what they said is that, you know, if your vehicle is, if you make $100,000 a year as a state employee, then in order to be a state employee, one of the conditions of employment would be to register your vehicle here. It's unfortunate that you have to go this way because some non-lawyer legislators have pointed out that the existing law is sufficient, which I would have agreed with a year ago, and I had at least six other lawyers look at it. The problem was getting the law enforcement to enforce it. So in conjunction with law enforcement, John Bell Edwards, Representative Edwards, came up with this law to force the issue. The only thing else I know to do to get the state police and Office of Motor Vehicles to comply would have been to list these a dozen or two dozen or so state employees making $100,000 a year, living in Baton Rouge, and refusing to obey the law.
All right. Does this so only apply, CB, to people earning over $100,000 a year?
Only applies. Those were the offenders. And I don't like writing laws like that, but the law is very clear that anyone coming to Louisiana and taking up residence, and these people weren't commuting from California, Florida, Nebraska, or wherever. So in order to force them to comply with the law, it was necessary to pass this law.
Well, it was filed after John Bell Edwards noted that a top Jindal official was driving a vehicle with New York plates. Who are we talking about?
No, that wasn't him. That's a part of the rumors that were put out by people probably trying to undermine me or Representative Edwards, because he's not a big Jindal supporter. They've tried to make it like this is all about Jindal. That issue was resolved by myself when one of the Jindal's top education advisors was working on the fourth floor, parking her car in a special place behind the Capitol with New York plates. I filed an informal complaint with the state police, and thanks to the state police, they forced her to go get her license plate. That was done almost a year ago.
Okay, so were you snooping around in the parking lot, CB?
No, I was having state employees who were very upset sending me pictures of these vehicles parked in various state office building parking lots. I sent them. First, I tried to get the department heads to comply with the law because the law requires any agency head to be responsible for notifying their employees. They wouldn't do it. I then filed complaints with the Inspector General, with the Office of State Police, and then the Office of Motor Vehicles. We're talking about 20 or so very high-paid people. One, in particular, at DHH, lived in Louisiana, lived in Baton Rouge for 2 years, refused to abide by the law, and then ultimately took a job in North Carolina and still had her Alabama plates on her car.
All right.
So I just think it's bad public policy for high-paid public officials in Louisiana to thwart the law, and it sets an example for everyone.
All right. Did that cause CB to go speechless?
No, I don't know. That was probably the wiretap kicking in.
All right. Well, let's get to a few other matters. Some might consider more substantive than this, but this is something.
Jim, I actually think following the law is about as substantive as you can get.
I'm with
you. And you can call it nitpicking if you want to, but under the broken windows theory, which cleaned up New York City, I think it's about time that we crack down in Louisiana.
I'm with you, and you got the man from West Point to enforce it, and Representative John Bel Edwards, and It is a worthy piece of legislation. I'm not diminishing this, but what about Medicaid? Chuck Cleckley, the House Speaker, says it's dead for 2013. Or do you agree?
Yes, because the law, the federal law, apparently allows the governor to make a decision on Medicaid, and the efforts by the legislature to actually exercise some independence has failed. And so I think that you can pretty well count it out for this legislative session.
Now, I know you're a big anti-tax person. You believe the government has plenty of money, just doesn't spend it wisely. It looks like a cigarette tax is dead on arrival for this session, and it doesn't matter whether it's 32 cents or 64 or $1.05. It's gone for this session, it appears. What's your take on this, CB?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about it, and what I find hypocritical is that Bobby Jindal himself proposed a dollar and a nickel tax on cigarettes, and not that he's now opposing it in Louisiana, but I find it hypocritical that he criticizes President Obama, who only proposed a 94-cent per pack cigarette tax. I just don't get it. I guess it's all about parties as to whether a tax is good or bad.
Okay, and if you go to one of your nice venues in Hammond that serves alcohol, if you have a concealed carry permit, you may be able to carry a weapon into a restaurant. If the House vote is embraced by the Senate, it was a 62-24 vote. It seems like guns are popular in the Louisiana legislature, CB.
Yeah, well, there's some misunderstanding about the existing law. I was one of the first people to get a concealed carry permit, and I've read the law pretty closely. And it's not that they serve alcohol. The requirement is that if you have a certain type of liquor license, which is the stereotypical smoky bar room where you can smoke, that has a liquor license that does not serve get 60% or more of its revenues from food, then you can't take a weapon in there now. There is nothing to prohibit you from taking a concealed carry permitted weapon into a restaurant that happens to serve liquor. The difference is that you would have to go and look at their liquor license that are posted on the wall to see the designation as a restaurant liquor as opposed to a bar liquor. So there are plenty places that serve liquor, and it is absolutely not illegal, and you're welcome to check this with the state police. That doesn't you don't just because there's a liquor in the restaurant doesn't mean you can't carry your weapon. In fact, I do very often.
A listener asks if, and CB, you would know this. Can you carry a weapon on your side into a restaurant right now? If
you want to take a chance on doing that, yes, you can take it anywhere. You can take it into.
I know you can
take
it down the street. I know you can do that. As crazy as that is, you can do it.
Unless they prohibit it, it's non-concealed. You may be arrested for other reasons and detained until they ascertain what your reasoning for it is, and then they will give you your gun back. So it's just that the concealment requires a permit.
HB in Denham Springs, please be brief. HB, you're on with CB.
Mr. Fagoston, how much would it help if the state of Louisiana suspended all tax credits everywhere that they're giving them and contribute that money back to health care and education?
HB, that would solve all our problems, and that's exactly what I've suggested numerous times. I have suggested that we not just suspend, but eliminate all sales tax exemptions and all income tax exemptions, credits, rebates, and so. And the result would be, according to the experts, not me, but according to the experts in Louisiana, that we would have just on a revenue neutral basis, it would lower the state sales tax to approximately 1.5 cents, the state's portion, and it would lower the personal income tax to 1%, and we could repeal the corporate income and corporate franchise tax. That was proposed to Governor Jindal. He turned it down.
House Appropriations Committee Chairman Jim Fannin, a Democrat from Jonesboro, is working with lawmakers to strip $500 million in non-recurring revenues from the governor's budget. Where is this going, CB?
I really don't know, Jim. That's a big deal, because what he's trying to do is he's not being fiscally conservative. He's addressing what's known as the Guyman rule in the House that said that there must be if the bill contains over a certain amount of one-time funds, then it cannot be heard by the House without a two-thirds vote to advance it. So it's not a fiscal conservative measure. It is a measure to allow the bill, the House appropriation bill, the state budget, to be considered on the House floor, because they have, apparently the hawks have the fiscal hawks, led by Brett Guyman, the votes to stop the bill from being heard with the fiscal, with the one-time money in it.
Well, the governor is creative in his budget. He's doing things like taking $100 million from the convention center in New Orleans and selling buildings downtown in Baton Rouge, and all of that is part of the budget. You've been there before. Is that something that is new?
Yes, it's new and it's only happened under Bobby Jindal, where we come up with fictitious revenues or contingency revenues. It's trying to use a loophole in the state constitution that prohibits contingency funding. Unfortunately, and I worried about that at the time we wrote that during the Constitutional Convention. I wasn't a delegate, but I was a senior staffer and debated that with then Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Al Tate. And I said, I'm worried about changing the language from note that you can't have a contingency appropriation to the current wording of you can't have appropriations under the heading of contingencies, because I said the legislature will eventually take advantage of that. And even though he was a mentor to me and a great friend, he said, "You're just too cynical, CB." And I periodically send him a message in heaven that I was right.
a bill sponsored by Blade Morrish, Republican from Jennings, to cap funding on TOPS was deferred by Senate Education Committee last week. As we know, tuition hikes are in order at campuses and places at, like LSU and Louisiana Tech, where almost all the student body is on TOPS. It seems like money is just going in a different location, but it still is a burden on the taxpayers. What about the effort to cap TOPS? Does this make sense?
No, it's absolutely wrong. And there wouldn't even be a discussion of this if Bobby Jindal hadn't reduced higher education funding in the last 5 years by over $600 million. TOPS is not the problem. It's the failure to have priorities. What has been the problem is that Bobby Jindal reduces funding for higher ed and then forces them to use the existing law to increase tuition to just get the money back. So it's a shell game, and I don't know why we should take it out on our students who are best qualified to get a college degree. I think it's unfair. We've made a commitment to these young people that when they get into the upper grades, if they follow a certain curriculum, make a certain grade level, that they will be able to go to any Louisiana public college without tuition. And I think it's wrong to breach that contract.
Wade Adams, friend of yours and mine, posting an email message from Louis this morning, says, I feel that CB's complaint about high officials maintaining out-of-state license plates is an important indication of how disconnected from Louisiana Governor Jindal's team has become.
I think Wade is right on it, as usual.
Well, it's been corrected, though. At least seemingly so.
No, it hasn't been corrected. That's the problem. Hence this legislation. I corrected it in the case of one person. Also, for 2 years, the chief of staff and the deputy chief of staff for the Department of Education did the same thing, drove their personal vehicles, parked them in special reserve spots in the education, the parking lot for the Department of Education. Finally, I got Colonel Mike Edmondson to personally intervene and to tell John White that he must have those people go out there and register. And Mike followed through on it and made sure and reported to me exactly when they went and paid their taxes and got their licenses.
Well, I sure hope I never get on your bad side, CB.
Jim, look, you know, you and other people act like it's a personal thing with me. It's not. It's just that I think that public officials should set the example of following the law. And that's all. And you know, if I would ever go after you, it would never be on personality. It'd be on an issue. And I don't understand why everybody takes it personal.
Well, thank you, CB. Always a pleasure, my friend. And let's talk again soon. We'll return after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're joined by a fascinating gentleman, Kishore Mahbubani. He is a professor and former Singaporean diplomat who served twice as ambassador to the United Nations, and he's currently the dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. That's where he's joining us. His latest work is The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. Good morning, Kishore Mahbubani.
Good evening from Singapore.
Yeah, it's late there, isn't it?
That's approaching 11 p.m. in Singapore. Yeah.
Okay, that's getting there. Well, you talk about how in the last 30 years, you write about this, three decades that we have seen more positive change than we did in the previous 300 years. Why do you believe this?
Well, I mean, if you look at the condition of humanity as a whole, in many dimensions, the 7 billion people on this planet have never been better off. Firstly, we've always worried about war and peace. And today, major interstate wars are becoming a sunset industry. And the number of people dying in interstate wars is the lowest it has ever been since statistics have been kept. Secondly, we always thought for a long time that we could never eradicate global poverty. But guess what? We're going to not just meet, but exceed the UN Millennium Development Goals of halving global poverty by 2015. And in fact, the U.S. National Intelligence Council has predicted that absolute global poverty will disappear by 2030. And thirdly, in terms of the explosion of middle classes, let me give you one statistic that will probably stun your listeners, which is that in all of Asia, from West Asia to East Asia, the total size of the middle classes is about 500 million people. But by 2020, which is only 7 years from now, that number will explode to 1.75 billion, an increase of 3.5 times in 7 years. And we have never seen this kind of dramatic improvement in the human condition as we are seeing today.
We're talking with Kishore Mahbubani. Foreign Policy has listed him as one of the top 100 global thinkers 3 times in the last 8 years. And hearing you, I'm hearing a voice of optimism. Quite often we hear about how bad things are, and we've got trouble around the world, no doubt. But you say global poverty is disappearing. Did I hear you right?
That's right, yes. In fact, these are figures provided by the United Nations and also by the U.S. National Intelligence Council. It's quite stunning. And, you know, the number of people, for example, rescued from global poverty in China in the last 30 years is about 700 million, and that's more than twice the population of the United States of America. That's a huge upliftment of humanity.
Do you think we have too many people on the planet?
Well, I mean, the good news is that, you know, one would have thought that the planet couldn't cope. But, you know, with modern technology growing and people becoming more intelligent in their capacity to take care of themselves, you find that overall the human condition is getting better and better. But of course, that we do face a challenge, I must emphasize, on the environmental front, because clearly, if, let's say, the Indians and Chinese begin to have the same living standards as the average Americans, then I think the planet cannot carry 5 or 6 Americas. So we have to find ways of compromising in our consumption.
Kishore, you write that the UN Security Council must reflect contemporary great power configurations and that the world order has to be reconstructed. How can it be done?
Well, fortunately, see, having served in the UN Security Council and having served twice as ambassador to the UN, I know why there has been no Security Council reform. Because each time you have a candidate coming in like Brazil, as a neighbor, Argentina, that says, why not me? And then if you have India, Pakistan says, why not me? But the most ingenious argument was given by the Italian ambassador to the UN when I was there. Because when everybody was pushing for Germany and Japan to get in, the Italian ambassador said, why are you pushing for Germany and Japan? We, Italy, we lost World War II also. So you could see how countries object to reform of the UN Security Council. That's why I have proposed a 7-7-7 formula, whereby we have 7 permanent members, 7 semi-permanent members, and 7 elected members, to ensure that it's a win-win-win formula for the great powers, the middle powers, and the small states.
Tracy at the Capitol asks your assessment as to the world's biggest hotspot right now. What's the biggest danger zone in the world today?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the world's biggest danger zone is hovering around the Middle East, you know. Because, you know, in most parts of the world, it's interesting. In Latin America, things are getting better and better. Even in Africa, things are getting better and better. In most of Asia, if you leave aside North Korea, things are getting better and better. But the Middle East region, I mean, if you look at what's happening in Syria and even in terms of the outcome of the Arab Spring in Egypt and elsewhere, the Middle East still remains a very troubled place, and I would worry about that region for a while more.
Well, only 12% of the world's population live in the West, and you have been a critic of the West. How does the U.S. stand in all this?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, I think Americans should be celebrating the fact that the American project has finally succeeded, because, you know, you wanted to share in some ways the best values of American society and civilization with the world, And you have succeeded. One reason why the world is getting better and better place is, as I explain in the book, various things that the world has learned from America, like free market economics, rule of law, the role of reason and logic, and so on and so forth. You've provided a tremendous number of good ideas for saving the world. But having created a better world, having created a world that is now more globalized, it is a tragedy that America, that has, in a sense, done more to globalize the world than any other country, is now one of the countries least prepared to handle the results of globalization. So this is why I argue in the book that America should be taking the lead in managing this transition to one world and not to oppose it.
Why are we not prepared in the United States for this?
Well, I think, you know, as you know, I begin the book by quoting from a speech given by Bill Clinton in Yale University in 2003, in which Bill Clinton says, if we assume in America that we'll be number one forever, then fine, we should carry on doing whatever we are doing. But if we can assume, if we can consider the possibility that we might be number two someday, surely it is in America's interest to create a rules-based world. So I think the essential resistance in America is that very few in America can conceive of the possibility that America might become number two someday. And that, as you know, according to IMF statistics, might happen sooner rather than later.
Well, if there is a country that supersedes the U.S. in global dominance, which country would it be?
Oh, I think in the short run, it'll be China. But in the medium term, people are also betting on India. But the good news is that as the new powers emerge, I want to emphasize one point. They have absolutely no desire to dominate the West. They want to replicate the West. They want to have the same kind of peaceful, middle-class societies that you have seen in the, you've seen in the West and in America especially. So we are actually creating a better and better world. We are creating a happier and happier world. But we must learn to cooperate more effectively now. And that's the reason why I wrote this book at this time, because I think we must start preparing for the different world that is coming.
You say common sense would dictate that if all 7 billion people who live on the same boat should elect or select a captain and crew to take care of the boat as a whole. What do you mean by this, Kishore?
Well, what I mean by that, you know, in the past, when the 7 billion people live in 193 separate countries, it was as though they were living in 193 separate boats with captains and crews to take care of each boat and rules to make sure the boats didn't collide. But today, with the world having shrunk and with the world becoming smaller and smaller, the 7 billion people effectively no longer live in 193 separate boats. The 7 billion people live in 193 separate cabins on the same boat. But the only problem with this boat is that you have captains and crews taking care of each cabin, the national governments, but you have no captain or crew taking care of the boat as a whole. Now, global government will not happen. That's impossible. But we can strengthen the institutions of global governance. So the institutions that were created by the United States in 1945, at the end of World War II, like the United Nations, World Trade Organization, IMF, World Bank, all these organizations can be strengthened. And I argue in the book quite strongly that it is in America's national interest today to strengthen these organizations.
The book is The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World, from Kishore Mahbubani. Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling me.
My pleasure. And now we're joined by a man who is recognized as perhaps the foremost food expert in the world, the author of 6 previous books, Michael Pollan. His latest is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Jim.
You go into the kitchen this time.
I do. It was the part of the food chain I hadn't really paid much attention to. After writing about, you know, agriculture and then writing about nutrition, this is the last link. This is the middle link. And it turns out to be the most important link in terms of its ability to influence what kind of agriculture we have. You know, when corporations are cooking our food, and fast food is the dominant way we're eating, we're going to have a huge industrial agriculture. They drive those changes. And then it also influences our health. And this was the big surprise to me, you know, that the most important fact about your diet is not what nutrients it contains, but who's cooking it. Is it being cooked by a human being, or is it being cooked by a food processing corporation?
Yeah, you accent the four classical elements, fire, water, air, and earth. How can we use those to transform the stuff of nature?
Well, you know, all cooking, I mean, you can go across cultures, and you will find that those four transformations are really the key. Cooking with fire, the simplest and oldest. Cooking with water in pots or any other liquid is, you know, I mean, think of, you know, there's so many great dishes that are made in pots, slow cooked. And then you've got air, which is bread, when we put air into food and to make it, to elevate it, basically, and make it more nutritious also. And then earth. Earth is cooking without the use of any heat, with using microbes instead, fermenting everything from milk and pickles and kimchi and alcohol. All of which are done with using microbes. So if you can master these four transformations, you can cook just about anything. And, you know, a lot of us aren't going to ferment food at home. And, you know, you can buy your live culture foods too, which is fine. But knowing how it's done, I think, informs the way you shop and the way you eat. And because... fermented food is really important to our diet, and as it has been to our history. Those foods have nutrients in them, have live bacteria that are actually very good for you.
We're talking with Michael Pollan. His latest work is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Now, in our fast-paced world, Michael, how do we have time to cook as you say we should?
Well, we're all working too much, it's true. But I see that people manage to make time for things they deem important. You know, we all make that time to get to the gym, or most of us do, because we know it's important to our health and our sanity. My argument in this book is cooking is just as important, both to your health and your sanity, that it's something we should make time for. And if we're strategic about it, it doesn't take that long. I mean, if you can, you know, make a lot of something on a Sunday, make a couple meals on a Sunday, in effect. If you're roasting a chicken, roast two chickens. It's no more work, and you have the basis for, you know, a couple meals during the week.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in the last 10 years, we've all found 2 hours a day to be on the Internet outside of work. Where did we find that 2 hours? You know, the day it didn't get any longer. It's still 24 hours. We just decided it was important. And my hope in this book is when you read it and you see just how interesting and pleasurable and significant this work is, that you will make a little more time for it, that you'll give it that half hour. For me, cooking has become that time in the day where I kind of reset. I get back in touch with my senses, which have been, you know, I've been in front of a screen all day. I talk to my wife and my kid, and it's become, you know, like taking a yoga class for me. I mean, it's really important to my sanity. So it's all in how you look at it. You can look at it as drudgery, or you can look at it as transformation, and transformation not just of the foodstuffs, but of yourself.
Now, if I remember right, Bill Moyers once suggested that you would be a good choice for head of the FDA. Why are you laughing?
I'm so glad that didn't happen.
Well, I think some people would agree. You know this subject well. We've got some issues that maybe need to be addressed more closely than they are. What's your take about food safety in this country and around the world?
Well, food safety is a very complicated issue. We're struggling with it right now. There's a lot of, you know, when you have an industrial food system where, say, your average hamburger might contain meat from, 150 different animals from four continents being ground together, there's going to be risks in that. And microbes love that kind of mixing and matching. And so I think when we industrialize our food system and, you know, wash, you know, the nation's salad in one big sink, which is essentially what we're doing with all those pre-washed greens, there are special risks that we have, and we have to deal with that. On the other hand, we have this renaissance of local agriculture and small artisanal food producers that would be crushed by the food safety regime you need to handle, you know, massive food processing facilities. So we have to figure out a sensible way to regulate food safety that curbs the worst industrial abuses, holds everybody to a standard, but doesn't crush these small farmers who are doing such great work to put much healthier, much fresher food on our tables.
Well, the latest work from Michael Pollan, who's a prolific writer and cooker, his book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation from Penguin Press. Thank you for joining us today, Michael. Quite a pleasure.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be here.
Take care. See you soon. And that'll do it for today. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Inkster. We thank you for listening. Hope you have a great day. Be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.